rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Werke, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is November 2nd, 2022. We have three cases on our oral calendar this morning. We have three cases on our non-oral calendar. And the first case, which I will call, is A21-1709, A21-1725, In re the Marriage of Whitney Ariane Blessing, petitioner, appellant, respondent. We have cross appeals versus Andrew David Blessing, respondent and appellant. Counsel, for appellant, you will have, both of you actually, will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Sorry, I'm automatically looking according to our signs and our norms, but you're beginning as the appellant, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. And you are?
John DeWalt, Your Honor, on behalf of Ms. Blessing.
Thank you, on behalf of Ms. Blessing. Excellent, thank you. And Mr. Zawiski, thank you. On behalf of Mr. Blessing. Excellent, thank you. So, 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. 15, 15, and 5, okay? Excellent. We have a multiplicity of microphones there. If you prefer and are comfortable taking the center podium, you're welcome to do so. That has a virtue of it goes up and down with the toggle switch, so it can adjust to your height. The other ones you would just move. If you prefer to be at your own, not to share a microphone, you can just certainly go to the podium next to you. Okay, I think with that, we're ready to begin with you, Mr. DeWalt, counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. Judge Wheelock, Judge Werke, presiding Judge Smith. It's good to see you in person again. Counsel. I'm Jack DeWalt. I am appearing on behalf of Ms. Whitney Blessing. Ms. Blessing is asking this court to overturn certain parts of the district court's order, while also asking the court to affirm other parts of that order as well. Certain parts of the district court's order were against logic and the facts of the case and were clearly erroneous, while other rulings the district court made as to credibility determinations and property findings were well within the district court's broad discretion to decide, and those parts should be affirmed. Turning to the first issue, Your Honors, the district court committed reversible error in its property division as it relates to its double counting of a marital cash gift to the parties. This is seen in the issue of a $220,000 cash gift that the parties received from respondent's mother that was determined by the district court to be marital, but whose value was then allocated to respondent twice.
And that issue, of course, is intertwined with your opposing counsel saying it was non-marital and he adequately traced, right? So they're kind of intertwined. It was the 220 from the mother of the respondent.
I would agree, Your Honor. It is certainly the same asset, and there is a dispute over to the marital versus non-marital character of that asset.
So if you stipulated that the property was 1.5, and if the 220 went into that amount, which obviously it did because that was before the stipulated value, we would then determine not only the characterization by the judge as to marital or non-marital of the 220, but also whether it was double counted. I mean, isn't there two issues in that?
I guess it would depend on how the court wanted to address that issue. I think if I understand the question, if the court were to rule in favor of respondent and determine the district court erred in finding it to be not marital and that in fact it was non-marital, I would assume that the tracing would have to take that 220 out of the overall 1.5 million valuation of the asset in question. So you would avoid, in that scenario, Your Honor, respondent would then be awarded his 220 as a non-marital plus whatever sort of increase in value the court might attribute to it. And then the remainder out of the $1.5 million of the real property would be divided however the court chose to, presumptively equally. Is that answering?
Yeah, just want to make sure that I understand the issues because of the cross appeal.
No, I understand. And I appreciate the question, Your Honor. I would say, though, that I think the double counting really only comes into play on my side of the file, or appellant side of the file. And the reason being is that once the district court determined that it was a marital asset, the entirety of that real property became marital. 1.5 became a marital asset per the district court. And then in our situation, as the court's already acknowledged, that 220 was invested into the property itself. That value was then divided by the court on the balance sheet. But then it was paid again.
So if we can just then hone in on your issue of the double counting, assuming it's marital property and that we would not reverse that if we take that assumption, that it's marital property, the 220. It's undisputed that it was used as a down payment for the property at 325. Is that correct?
I believe the record supports that it was testified to both parties that it was used as an investment into the real property that the parties acquired.
Okay. And then, so we have what's on the balance sheet. I understand what how that works. Your argument is it's accounted for within the 1.5.
Yep.
And then there's the separate provision of the district court's order that says that once the refinancing is accomplished, that Ms. Blessing must pay $110,000 to Mr. Blessing, right? And your argument is essentially, and there's, I think, a lien for the equalization payment of $267,000 or that amount. So your argument is she should not have to pay $267,000 plus $110,000. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And is there any question in your mind about, is that what the district court's order means? I mean, could the district court, does the order, is that what the order means, that she must pay both of those, as opposed to perhaps the 110 upon refinancing would actually reduce the amount of the lien?
I wish it was.
Okay.
I wouldn't argue the issue. absolutely not. I think that the 220 is plainly attributed within the judgment decree as related to the cash gift. That's how we get to the 110 number that's to be paid by Ms. Blessing. And again, that's the same asset that was invested into the real property. And I don't know how you can count the same asset of 220 twice, both within the value of the real property that was allocated between the parties as a marital asset, and then a second time as an independent cash asset.
But Mr. DeWalt, let's presume that the panel agrees with you.
Sure.
Can we fix that as an order, or do we have to send it back and instruct the court to fix it? How do you see us remedying that for you?
I understand. I've been asked that question before, and I've always struggled with it, because I think the court can probably do a multitude of things here, Your Honor. I think one way you simply fix it is it's an error. I think it's an error to double count that amount twice, and I think it's been allocated as part of the real property. So I think the court could correct that error as it's plain on its face. I think the court could also say this is an asset that has been valued within the real estate once, and if there is a remand, it is not to be treated as an independent asset that way. Those would be the two ways I think the court would most likely handle that issue,
so,
Your Honor.
With that answer in mind, because I think and I understand that the $32,000, the attorney's money, the trust account money, it sounds as if you both agree that there was an error on that. Can we fix that, or do we need to send that back?
I think the logic applies equally to that example as it is to the first example, Your Honor. There is not a dispute about that amount there. I think they're both erroneous. And to the same extent, if the court wanted to remand with instructions on how to treat those two assets on the balance sheet, I think the court would well within its rights to do so, and I think the court could also find These are plainly erroneous on their face, and...
Can we speak to the $32,000 question for a moment? What is the prejudice of... The balance sheet, what is the prejudice of the district court? I think the district court, as I recall, and unfortunately I failed to bring my balance sheet with me. I'll pull up another one. But the district court put that in the balance sheet as $32,000 all entirely to Mr. Blessing. Is that right? And the parties agreed that it was $16,000 each. Is that right?
If I recall the facts, Your Honor, correctly, that amount in question had already been divided between the parties had already agreed that that would be allocated between each other. So by placing it into Mr. Blessing's column entirely, in fact, my client, again, and I'm just stating the facts, would benefit from the same money twice, exactly the same type of...
But if there's a sum of money that they agree in advance is going to go to one, to both of them, okay?
Yes.
So $32,000 is going to 16 to each, right? That's the agreement. And so, right, is that what I under, am I making a mistake?
No, that is the agreement. I think the...
Okay. So then instead, the balance sheet shows it as $32,000 going to Mr. Blessing.
Sure.
Okay. What difference, if you just redo the math,
no.
The equalization payment goes up or down. It's like an equal and opposite reaction on the other side of it. What is the prejudice of that?
I understand the question, Your Honor, and I appreciate the question, too. You're absolutely correct. If I understand the question correctly, which is by placing it on there, you're actually effectuating the intent of the parties, which is you each get equal values. I assume that's what I'm being asked, Your Honor. Is that correct?
Right. You either get it by the $32,000 there with a zero,
right.
You know, or right. You split it in half and an equalization
sure.
payment
sure.
changes.
I think this would be an argument that will probably be argued here in a few moments by counsel, but what I would say is I think the prejudice would come into the fact if that money had already been divided off of the balance sheet, for example, there would be concern over whether or not there's an undue benefit. But I take the court's point, which is
you mean if they already split up the money?
Correct.
Previously?
Correct.
Well, then someone might have to repay that if they're not, right? And if it's...
I think that's the concern, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about the questions around the $4,400 Park Avenue property?
Sure.
Okay. So I think there were questions about what the district court's order ended up looking like relative to that, where I think the original order was that the parties sold the property after the valuation date before the J&D, right, for $91,000.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then there were some liabilities that they agreed would be paid, obligations that they would be paid out of that. The remainder would go to Mr. Blessing, right, as marital property. Is that it?
The remainder would be treated as a marital asset for division.
Yes.
And in this situation, that asset, because the real property was awarded to one party, the cash asset would be used as an offset to the other party.
Right. And correct. So, and then I think in post-trial motions, it was like, let's specify what that amount was. It was $69,000 was the remainder. The last order says the $69,000. This, I think, undisputedly marital property, right?
I don't believe there's dispute, Your
yeah.
Honor.
Would be allocated to Mr. Blessing, is that right?
As non-marital property.
Well, I think the order said the remainder will be $69,000. Then the balance sheet says the whole 91 as non-marital,
correct.
His non-marital.
Correct.
And then splits the obligations between them.
Correct.
Does that, I think you say in the briefing that, well, if you're going to correct the obligations, the whole thing should be corrected. Like the $91,000 doesn't belong in the, unless I have the parties.
I was going to say, I don't mean
it might be the cross appeal problem.
I certainly
for
don't,
me,
yeah, I don't mean to correct the court. I don't believe that was in my brief. I do, that was, I think that was in respondent's brief that if correction should occur, then all corrections should occur.
Okay, I have the party. I'm sorry to confuse the parties, but I guess my question is, what's wrong with that, and is it necessary to do? I mean, I don't understand what $91,000 is doing in non-marital and why you would have obligations related to this money in the marital mix property allocation, but not the actual $69,000 in the marital mix.
Well, I think you would, I think it's just clearly erroneous. I think that's the problem with the balance sheet, frankly, is, and it speaks, it's plain on its face. I mean, in all fairness, I think it's a plain error on its face. The practical effect is that by taking the gross sum of $91,000 and taking it off of the balance sheet and putting it into one party's non-marital column, you have reduced the marital assets by the corresponding amount. The bottom line equalizer then has shifted, so one party in reality has received the benefit of a full $91,000, non-divisible, as a non-marital asset, individually, independently, and then 50% of the remainder marital asset getting paid again for sums.
Can I ask you? You say there's clear error here.
Yeah.
What should the balance sheet, in your view, should the balance sheet be corrected to show relative to this 4400 Park Avenue property?
I think it should have reflected to the initial agreement that both parties put forward to the court, which was that the remainder of that $91,000 following payment of agreed upon debts, which was the CPA debt, was the tax debt, those debts that were identified, that the remainder is treated as a marital asset, give or take 60 some odd thousand dollars. I don't recall the exact number offhand, I apologize. Treated as a marital asset, and then in this case, awarded to Mr. Blessing in full as an.
Okay, so when we look at the columns,
correct.
Whether you do it by taking 91 and taking the debts off, or you just start with the 69, whatever the net is, that 69,000 is a marital asset, belongs in that column, and it's allocated to Mr. Blessing, and it belongs in his column.
I agree, 100%.
Is that right? And then the obligations disappear from both columns.
Then the obligation is divided equally. It's disappeared as marital debts for the parties because the parties have already stipulated to the agreement payments of those debts.
And 69,000 presumes they're already paid. We're talking about a net, right?
Absolutely, 100% correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and so that would correct that problem. Put $69,000 in Mr. Blessing's marital.
Yeah, and again, I think in fairness, I think that's the way the parties intended that $69,000 to be treated was as a marital asset. I'm sure there might be some dispute about who should get it and how it's divided relative to the real property, but there really wasn't a dispute, I don't believe, relative to marital versus non-marital. So I think it clearly is erroneous. I see I'm just about out of time. I don't know if there's any other questions the court has. Otherwise, I'm happy to conclude.
You will have 5 minutes for
rebuttal.
So I see no questions. We'll listen
Perfect.
To you then. Great, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Chris Sawiski on behalf of Andy Blessing. I can start in with a recitation of the things I have here, but it seems like maybe the questions you would rather prefer to just ask them regarding the property.
Well, I want to know about the 220. I mean, both of you had tracing experts. I mean, I've obviously not been a district court judge for a while. I've not had testimony from tracing experts. But on that whole issue, doesn't it come down to a credibility call when you have a judge having mother of your client testify, and my recollection of the order is that she was not credible?
Well, so yes, what the district court judge found, and let me start by saying that this judgment decree is rife with errors. I mean, it's a mess.
And the other thing that I can't help but reflect on is I'm maybe it's a Ramsey County policy, but I rarely see balance sheets prepared by the trial court judge. You try to reach an equitable division. You start with a balance sheet. If you don't have a CPA doing it, you're just asking for trouble and asking for all sorts of inconsistencies or just reframing of where something went. But, you know, the very fact that the 220, however it was applied, however it's to be repaid, if it's characterized as marital, how do you defeat a credibility finding? Because that is there.
Well, so let me start with that part, which is the non-marital part of the equation, which is my client has a check. That's how this started. It is from an account from his mother
to him. To him only.
Correct. And his mother testified both in deposition and at trial that that was either a gift or inheritance. My client testified it was either a gift or inheritance. Even the email that the appellant points to in 2016 says he's disappointed that mom, the donor, is calling it an inheritance. So it was his understanding it was a gift. The difference was not necessarily that it was a gift or inheritance, because to the mom, that means the same thing to her. What she's thinking is, I'm giving it to my son. And she testified to that. Now, the court basically found her testimony at trial to be worthless. And we're going to go to the deposition, and there's a specific finding on that. The deposition specifically says, Mom, Leslie Blessing, finds that this is either a gift or inheritance and was meant solely for her son. That's the findings. And that's the fact in this case. The problem is that if you determine credibility based on, you know, mom doesn't understand the difference on her donative intent, and Eric Olson, who was a third party who knew nothing about the transaction regarding the non-marital claim, but had a disagreement with my client over his employment status, and you find that my client's not credible based on that, then you can go back and you can make specific findings that say this check is worthless for these reasons. There are no findings on the check. He makes
Why could it not be a gift to both of them? Why would the check that's written only
really,
to him be thrown out?
There's really no evidence that it's a gift to both of them. There was testimony by one.
It wasn't like it was a Christmas card or in a birthday card or anything like that. It was just a check. It wasn't in something to demonstrate perhaps that it was marital. Is that what you're...
Correct. It was for mom, and mom's testimony later on in deposition was that it was to her son alone. That's what she meant to do. And certainly the check bears that out.
Was the check used toward the property?
Yes.
Is there any dispute about that?
Nope. Both sides agree.
Okay, so there was a check that was given by mom, written to son, that the couple used as a down payment while they're married in their
joint
home.
Okay. Correct. And that was for $220,000, and we traced it. Now, the interesting thing about that tracing is there was no cross-examination, there was no challenge. So, as far as I understand, that direct testimony is in and the evidence is in. The report of Mr. Hargis, their expert on the tracing, differs from the Dorweiler standard, the Schmidt standard, and that was attacked at trial. It doesn't need to be, I think, gone into today. I think the issue is whether or not this court believes that it's a non-marital gift based on the check and the testimony. Now, I understand that a district court can say, I don't believe one party or the other. The problem is, if you're doing that in this case, then you have to go to mom's testimony, which is consistent both at trial and in her deposition, which is that it was a gift or inheritance, and it was meant for her son.
The court makes credibility findings on that. You had two experts. You had the tracing and the tracing, so, you know, the judge looks at that, too.
Sure.
I mean, I think what I was hearing you say is that mom, and I feel bad for mom, but that she is in the middle of this because of the 220. But, you know, the court has the ability to look at the witnesses and decide maybe what's at the bottom of it or perhaps something more with the occasion. That's what I was trying to say about birthday, the occasion of the gift to son.
Sure.
And as Judge Smith said, it's to buy the property. That occasion seems to be the property for both of them.
But there is no, and so if this court looks to Olson, which is the case that talks about how you look at it and donative intent, which is what this court relied upon in its findings, one of the pieces of evidence, and a big piece of evidence according to Olson, is donative intent by the function of the transfer of the check. The check itself is proof of donative intent. And that's set forth in Olson, and I think is clear in this case. And the problem is, when you then step into a non-marital evaluation of a non-marital claim, my guy as the proponent of the claim, has the burden of proof. Okay, so he came in. He provided the check. He provided the tracing. He did all the things that were necessary. His mother testified as to whether it was at trial or in deposition. And if the trial testimony is worthless, then the deposition testimony has to be worth something. And in those, in both settings, she affirmed it. So, and my client affirmed it. Now, you can say because he had a fallout with his co-business owner or his, you know, employer, whatever you call that, and his credibility was low because of that. I don't know that that really goes to the issue of non-marital as it does to his relationship with that individual person.
If we were to, moving into some of the other issues,
sure.
If we were to find that the district court did, or conclude that the district court did not commit plain error, or excuse me, clear error, and that the 220 is in fact marital property, is it your view, as I think opposing counsel talked about, that the district court's order would require payment not just of the equalization payment, but on top of that, the $110,000? And if that's the case, why would that not be erroneous?
So my concern with the $110,000, and I think I laid this out in respondent's brief or in my client's brief, which was the idea that so the district court made these specific findings about that it was a gift, and the appellant wants us to credit those findings, that it was a gift to both parties, those types of things, and then issues an award to my client in the conclusions for $110,000 representing his gift. Is that double counting on its face? It may be. The problem with it is, I don't know that the district court understood the difference. And that's why I have a concern on the non-marital claim. If you are going to say that I'm giving this gift back, that tells me that the district court didn't understand the standard for non-marital to begin with.
So it comes back to the marital, non-marital issue.
I think it does. And I think that's clear. I mean, the findings, you know, there is no discussion of the tracing. There is no discussion of the check except one quick finding that says there is a check. There is no discussion of the $130,000. That was there. All of that is just set aside. And he has six findings on credibility. That's it. And that determines the value. And then you have a conclusion that says $110,000 to my client. I get that that's error, but I think that's error because I don't think there was an understanding of the trial court in this case as to what non-marital actually is. And I think that bears out through a lot of the findings and conclusions here because there's a ton of error. And, oh.
Do you want to, would you mind turning to the 4400 Park?
Not at all.
Okay.
Do you have a specific question or you just want me to?
Tell me what you think the balance sheet should look like.
The balance sheet should look like $69,000.
$69,000 where?
In my client's comp, because that's theoretically what the court was ordered.
$69,000 marital property allocated
correct.
To Mr. Blessing.
And the debt should have been removed. So if the court recalls, and let me just take a sidestep here. Yes, we agree on the Caney monies. That should have been agreed to a long time
ago.
Sorry,
disagree on what?
The Caney trust monies, the $32,000. That should have been either 16 in each column or it should just be zeros.
Because they already distributed.
Yeah, but to put $32,000 in my client's column as if it hadn't been distributed means he has to come up with $16,000 to pay the other side, which he's already done.
I don't want to take away from your time, but did you not discuss some of these issues in appellate mediation?
Yes.
Oh, all right.
I mean, I don't want to go too far.
I'm always wondering what happens. I mean, I can't help pontificating, if you will, because of been a trial court judge for so long. You know, I mean, these parties were so successful. They amassed quite a bit. Poor kids, you know, obviously a loving grandmother that's trying to help them out. And to me, it just seems like, well, all right, those are personal comments, not appropriate for appellate review.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't want to go too far into appellate mediation. That
sure.
doesn't seem fair to
no,
either side.
No, I'm not
side.
Asking. I just so. Sometimes there just is no engagement in appellate mediation. That was my only question. And
yes.
I'm sorry I took away from your time.
Oh, no, you're fine. To go back to 4400. So the issue there is that the original judgment decree showed a balance of $91,000, then put the debts in both. And so both sides had an equal amount of debt, but then my client had the 91. What should have been done is all of the debt either went into his column minus the 91, which would have been 69, or as this court basically said, you could have put the 69 into his column. We agree on that issue as well. That should be fixed. Whether
how do you see this going back to the trial court?
I think it's a remand to fix it, and frankly,
I mean, it sounds like you both agree. It's
yeah, on those two issues, I don't know the... you know, obviously, he's Mr. DeWald and his client is going to disagree over the non-marital issue, and I'm going to disagree over the double counting issue.
Is there
issue.
Any reason that if this is a remand from this court that we would suggest to the trial court to open the record for more testimony? Is there any reason to have a more robust record? It sounds as if you had pretty much everything at the time.
I don't know that a more robust record is necessary. I wouldn't object. I'm a trial attorney in family law.
What about on the 220?
I don't know that there's any more available to provide there. I'm always for having whatever information the trial court thinks it needs. So I'm always fine if the Court of Appeals and the couple cases that I've had that have been done this way, if the court decides. The trial court wants more information, great.
So you have a couple minutes left.
Yep.
I know we've consumed your time with perhaps our questions. What do you want to hit as the major?
Well, so from my perspective, I think the most important issue is the non-marital. And I think my client, met his...
30, I suppose.
Excuse me?
The 220
yes,
and the 130.
Yes, and the 130. And I think those things were not dealt with. There's a lack of findings on them. I think on that alone, it should be sent back and re-looked at.
The 130 was brought up in the court's order in terms of recognizing for the amended findings, recognized it.
Correct.
District court didn't make changes.
No.
Doesn't our case law generally suggest that the district court, described the issue, didn't amend the findings your way, didn't implicitly reject the argument that 130 was proved to be?
Yes, you could make that argument. I think the judgment decree should represent that. It should say in the judgment decree, me bringing it back to the court to say, hey, you didn't deal with this issue, and the court saying, the district court saying, no, I didn't, but I don't care, is, I think, not helpful in terms of what the judgment decree looks like. And if that's the issue, then the appellant's issue on the new trial motion is the same thing. The district court said, no, we're not interested in that. I would make one little note, and it just quickly, because I only have 30 seconds left, but the issue of the division of the debt, which is... there's debt in my client's column in his name. There's debt in the other party's column in her name. And then there's about four or five debts that show up as split. That should be fixed. It's against the logic and facts of the case where we've split out everything else. The only reason he did it, I don't know, because the submission by the other side included it that way. And it was a way to reduce the amount of money that would have to be paid. There's no reason that my client, and I'll just finish this quick thought, who has these in his name should have to go collect these debts from the other side. It's just easier to have them paid from the property settlement, and that's the whole point of doing it. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll just address the credibility issue head on. The court made numerous findings on credibility. District court is in the best position to determine credibility of witnesses. That's what we rely on as an appellate review. And the real question becomes, was the court's credibility determinations so erroneous as to be unsupported by the facts or the record before the court? It certainly was not. There was ample evidence before the court, which the court noted in its judgment decree regarding why it found Ms. Blessing's testimony to not be credible. And I think specifically, I think it is persuasive that there are documentary exhibits that were entered into evidence engaging emails that were written by respondent. So these were contemporaneous events prior to a divorce while the parties were still married. And in those emails, for example, petitioner's exhibit 148, respondent clearly states to his mother, this is an email from respondent to his mother, stating 7 years ago you gifted Whitney and I equity in Raleigh.
You have Exhibit 143, Petitioner's Exhibit 143, another email from respondent, authored to mother's attorney at that time. This is in 2008, again, well before a divorce, while the parties are still married, reflecting that his mother's intent to gift us the equity in the house, and then talking about taking advantage of gifting the gift tax for Ms. Blessing, for not only Mr. Blessing, Andy, and Whitney, but also their children. So it's simply erroneous, I think, to state that the record doesn't support that finding, and I think it would be somewhat folly to step into the shoes of a district court judge and say, based on the record before us here, we think your credibility determinations were improper. I'd also like to address specifically the idea that Judge Yang did not understand what he was doing with regard to his allocation of marital versus non-marital. That was spelled out. That's plainly spelled out in the judgment and decree. The district court made credibility findings on that issue with regard to marital versus non-marital, gifting versus non-gifting, and then specifically concluded this is a marital asset. That 220 was a marital asset. So this is not part, this is not something that was sort of thrown in or slipshod. It was specifically addressed, and I think as the court's already noted, if there was some mistake, Judge Yang certainly had the opportunity to correct that mistake when the parties had post-trial arguments. I'd finally conclude on that point, Your Honor, we're always going to presume, again, it is the burden of the party putting forward a non-marital, and when it comes to both credibility and gifting, a district court does have broad discretion to determine whether or not the characterization of an asset is marital versus non-marital. With regard to the allocation of debts as raised before the court, I'd simply, again, identify that not being unhappy with how the district court allocates property is not the same as correcting an error. An error is something that was done wrong. District court should have the purview to divide property the way the court does decide that it should divide property. That's what our case law tells us. And I do think that whether or not we agree, it could be easier to mechanically or practically manage a debt or an asset. I don't think that constitutes grounds to reallocate or redivide or reassign that debt for division, given the fact the district court does have that authority. Unless the court has other questions, I can conclude my argument today.
We'll take the minute. All right. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate being here today.
Yep. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thank you for your arguments.
Thank you.